again, everybody, for joining us today for a really important discussion about offshore oil drilling in the Southeast United States. Before we dive into the heart of our presentation, I just want to say thank you for being with us. And Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, a little history on our organization. We've been around as an advocate for clean and responsible energy choices in our communities for over 20 years. We have offices throughout the region in Atlanta, Georgia, Knoxville, Tennessee, Asheville, North Carolina, and many satellite offices in South Carolina, Florida, and other parts of the states that I already mentioned. Since 1985, we have grown to become a really dynamic organization that concentrates on many levels of decision making, from federal, state, and even at the local levels, and doing pilot projects in our communities to really test and show the opportunities that clean energy can bring us in our region. So I'd like to invite everybody to visit our website, cleanenergy.org. We have a lot of information about the issues. We are doing these webinar series on a monthly basis. And would invite you to continue to listen into these series, because we're trying to bring cutting-edge information to our members and our supporters and folks who want to learn about these issues, so that we can provide as much of the best information as possible to you all to help us in leading our region to a clean energy future. We also have a new blog that I would encourage you to visit, blog.cleanenergy.org. And we're bringing these issues, as well as in the webinar series, on a regular basis through the blog. So I'll go ahead and turn it over now to Tony Rialli to go into the bulk of the presentation.
Great. Thanks, Ula. Joining us today as well is Susan Glickman. Susan is located in Florida and is a consultant for Southern Alliance for Clean Energy and works on all climate energy issues in Florida. So we'll advance to the next slide. And just so you know, Susan may chime in during the webinar presentation. She's got a wealth of information to share. So, Susan, I definitely invite you to, add any points that I may miss.
Very good. Thanks, Tony, and thanks for setting this up. And I'm looking forward to spending some time with everybody on the phone.
Thank you. So here's the Southeast from space, and the Southeast coast is home to more than 16 million residents, and the property value along the shoreline alone totals $2.2 trillion. We rely on the more than 2,000 miles of coastline as an economic engine that attracts diverse visitors and outdoor enthusiasts who enjoy the region's coastal marshes, barrier islands, and other unique natural and historic features. Coastal tourism activity creates thousands of jobs and generates billions of dollars in revenue across our region. This is a choice we are faced with as the threat of opening up our coast to drilling becomes more and more evident. Do we choose to protect our pristine beaches and our coastal economy, or do we sell off our coast and our future to big oil? This is an image of Queensland, Australia, following a spill in March of this year. In this webinar, Susan Glickman and I will take apart the most common arguments that pro-drillers use when making the case to open up our outer continental shelves to big oil. We will answer the following questions. Can the Southeast afford the risk? Is the technology that is utilized around the world safe? Will drilling impact tourism? Will we see lower prices at the pump? Can offshore drilling lead to U.S. energy independence? Can we drill out, and what are our options? Lastly, Susan will discuss the role that mystery oil money and dirty politics are playing in the struggle to keep Florida's beaches and tourism-based economies safe from drilling. What is going on in Florida right now has significant regional implications. There are lessons for all of us who do not live in Florida to learn from, as most of our Southeast leaders are pushing for the expansion of offshore drilling. Opening up our Southeast waters to offshore drilling puts our region's coast and our ocean economies at risk. These sectors bring in hundreds of billions of dollars to our region and supplies millions of jobs. These sectors are the lifeblood of many of our Southeast states. On this slide, here are just a few examples of the economic benefits that our Southeast coasts bring to our states. In 2008, Virginia's coastal tourism industry brought in over $19.2 billion in revenue and supplied over 200,000 jobs. In 2006, Florida's coastal economy contributed $562 billion in revenue, 5.8 million jobs, and $226 billion in wages. Each year, North Carolina fisheries have a $2.3 billion impact on the state's economy, especially among the highest in the nation. So in the next couple slides, we will take a look at the safety record of the technology that is being used around the world. Big Oil's track record with offshore drilling is ugly. Offshore operations have had 40 large-scale spills since 1964. 13 of those have been in the past 10 years alone, and those are just the biggest spills. Smaller spills are still an everyday occurrence and continue to impact our coastlines. Offshore operations are especially vulnerable during hurricanes, a very real threat where the majority of oil drilling occurs. In the past 10 years, 7 major spills have been hurricane-related. A common argument is that offshore drilling platforms and related infrastructure are hurricane-proof. In fact, Louisiana's governor said that there were no significant spills after Katrina and Rita. He called it the unwritten success story. In fact, after Katrina and Rita, 113 oil platforms, 457 pipelines were damaged, releasing 9 million gallons of oil, and over 500 specialists were flown into southern Louisiana to clean up after the spills related to Hurricane Katrina. This industry is not safe nor clean, as some would claim. Offshore oil and gas drilling is an industry that has the potential to cripple our coastal communities, and the Australians would agree. Just a few months ago, on August 21st, an oil platform off Western Australia ruptured and took nearly 11 weeks to stop the massive spill that is estimated to have released between 6 and 9 million gallons of oil. On November 3rd, the company that is, quote, using the latest drilling technology and is also responsible for the spill reported that their fifth attempt to kill the leaking well on the platform succeeded, shutting off the uncontrolled flow of oil and gas that has been polluting the water and air off Western Australia since the blowout. They also reported that the fire that engulfed the platform and the attached drill rig has also been extinguished. Right after the spill occurred, slicks could be seen from coastal towns more than 200 kilometers from the platform. Australia's coastal environments, communities, and economies were at risk of a national disaster.
Well, let me just break in for a second. One of the things that's really important about the spill in the blowout in the Timor Sea is that when the Florida Energy Associates, and I'll get into more of that later, but they're sort of the folks pushing, the lead folks pushing this drilling effort, had in their materials like a whole sort of section devoted to putting up Western Australia, the new technology, or what they call visionary leadership in Western Australia and overcoming significant obstacles to drilling. And so they're touting the leadership of Western Australia, and this is exactly the same type of rig, what's called a jackup rig, that they were promising for Florida. And of course, as unfortunate as the spill has been, it did, you know, we've tried to make the use of it in pointing out that it not only is it the same technology, but, you know, it's not particularly necessarily safe. So anyway, this is exactly the technology that they were promising for Florida.
Thanks, Susan, for adding that. I'll advance to the next slide here, which shows a pretty compelling image. SkyTruth, a 501c3 that uses digital mapping to educate the public and policymakers about the environmental consequences of human activities, wanted to illustrate what could happen if an Australian-style blowout occurred in the eastern Gulf of Mexico. What they did is they outlined the area in the Timor Sea where the slicks and sheen were detected across 2,500 square miles on a satellite image and overlaid that area along the Florida coast. Now, using a model that accounts for ocean currents, this illustration shows the slicks originating from a point 80 miles offshore from Tampa Bay. On their website, skytruth.org, I believe, they have other images of this blowout and how it would look if it happened in the Eastern Gulf. I highly recommend you check those out. of the Timor Sea spill was a direct result of drilling operations. However, even without drilling, the transportation and storage of fuel has a long record of threatening our coastal communities and ecosystems. In August 2000, 85 tons of tar washed ashore from Pompano Beach to North Miami Beach. Nearly 8,000 turtle hatchlings, 25,000 pounds of fish, and a dozen shorebirds were killed. In October of this year, more than 50 people from the Coast Guard, the South Carolina Department of Health and Environmental Control, the South Carolina Department of Natural Resources, and contractors from around the country participated in a 10-day cleanup and assessment of approximately 60 miles of shoreline around the Charleston area. Tar balls washed up from Isle of Palms to Folly Beach from a transfer spill that originated in the Charleston Harbor. Crews removed more than 2,600 bags filled with oily debris and sand for a total effort of more than 550 man-hours at a cost of approximately $330,000. This wasn't the first spill in Charleston. In 2002, an incident in which nearly 13,000 gallons of heavy bunker oil oozed into the harbor and waterways and polluted 15 miles of shoreline. What happened was a ship ran into unmarked and submerged sections of steel dredge pipe and ruptured a fuel tank. The resulting oil spill soiled wildlife, boats, creeks, marshes, and piers all the way from North Charleston down to Folly Beach. The $4 million cleanup took months and involved the combined efforts of local, state, and federal agencies. As a result of the spill, clam farmers said their collective inventory was almost entirely destroyed, dropping more than 90%. So now let's take a look at how onshore infrastructure associated with offshore drilling might alter our coasts. You can ask anyone who lives in Mississippi, Louisiana, or Texas, who lives along the coastline, what coastal infrastructure associated with offshore drilling has done to their communities. Storage tanks, pipelines, and industrial facilities would forever alter our shorelines. And oil processing plants require great quantities of water, which would stress already stressed local water supplies. And of course, onshore infrastructure, coupled with any potential spills, would significantly alter and threaten our ocean and coastal ecosystems. According to the Virginia Conservation Network, current drilling projects in the Gulf of Mexico have destroyed more wetlands than exist between New Jersey and Maine. Our wetlands absorb storm energy, thereby reducing hurricane damage. They also provide habitat supporting diverse wildlife and aquatic life that in turn supports valuable game and commercial fisheries. Offshore drilling, including exploration for natural gas, results in waste mud containing toxic metals that get dumped into surrounding waters every day, putting additional strain on already stressed coastal ecosystems. According to the National Academy of Sciences, a single well produces between 1,500 and 2,000 tons of waste material. Debris includes drill cuttings, which is rock ground into pieces by a drill bit, and drilling mud brought up during the drilling process. This mud contains toxic metals such as lead, cadmium, and mercury. Other pollutants such as benzene, arsenic, zinc, and other known carcinogens and radioactive materials are routinely produced in, quote, produced water, which emerges when water is brought up from a well along with oil or gas. Additionally, there is strong evidence that oil actually becomes more toxic over time as it slowly degrades into the environment. And often, the last compounds to degrade are those that are known human carcinogens. Another common myth is that offshore drilling would lead to lower prices at the pump. Let's take a look at that argument. There is no correlation between drilling and lower gas prices because oil prices are set on a global market. The Department of Energy admits that, quote, because oil prices are determined on the international market, however, any impact on average prices is expected to be insignificant. Looking at this graph, on the x-axis you have time. On the left y-axis you have the number of wells drilled. On the right y-axis you have the price of gas. The green line represents the price of gas over time, And the red bars are the drilling permits issued, and the blue are the wells drilled. You could see over time that gas prices have risen as the number of wells drilled and drilling permits have increased. So again, there's no correlation between drilling, more drilling and lower gas prices. The bottom line here is profit. Domestically drilled oil will not stay in the United States if another nation is willing to pay more. Any oil pumped here goes right into the international market, where we have to bid for it alongside India, China, and other nations. Now, legislation like the American Climate and Energy Security Act and the Clean Energy Jobs and American Power Act is how Americans will save money with efficiency and renewables. Now let's look at if expanding offshore drilling could lead the U.S. to energy independence. More drilling will not achieve energy independence. At current consumption levels, U.S. resources are inadequate to achieve energy independence. The U.S. contains 2.5% of the world's oil reserves and 3% of the world's natural gas resources, but we account for 24% of total consumption of oil. The U.S. could drill every national park, wildlife refuge, and coastline and still be importing 60% of the oil we use. The U.S. oil is just really a drop in the bucket. Opening up drilling in the U.S. can never make us less dependent on foreign oil. On slide 23, we see an image that was printed in the New York Times in March of this year. The official estimate is that areas that were previously off limits contain about 18 billion barrels of undiscovered oil. But oil executives argue that this underestimates the potential because exploration has been curtailed in these areas for three decades. So looking in this at this graph or this image, looking at the eastern Gulf of Mexico and the Atlantic, there is a 95% chance that 1.12 billion barrels of oil can be found, a 50% chance that 3.82 billion barrels of oil can be found, and 5% chance that there is 7 billion barrels of oil out there to recover. The Minerals Management Service estimates that the Atlantic only has 3.8 barrels of technically recoverable oil. Using Minerals Management Service's estimates for the Eastern Gulf and the Atlantic, again, there's only a 50% chance that 7.7 billion barrels of oil could be technically recovered. The U.S. consumes 20 million barrels of oil a day. The reserves off our white sandy beaches would only run our country's fuel addiction for just 13 months. Is this really a risk that we are willing to take for such little benefit? The only way we will ever reduce our dependency is to reduce our consumption. Federal legislation that promotes clean alternative energy, fuel efficiency, and cuts global warming pollution will reduce our oil imports four times more than drilling. This is a really nice graph from the National Wildlife Federation report of 2008 that shows on the left there all combined areas for drilling, the Arctic refuge, offshore, Rocky Mountains, etc. And then if you look on the right, the blue bar shows how much oil we would actually save if we were to implement responsible and meaningful climate and energy legislation. So let's not forget the bigger picture here. If we allow drilling, we backtrack on our nation's goal of reducing our dependence on fossil fuels and reducing our contribution to global warming. We know what is at risk, and we know that we have alternatives. So if drilling isn't the answer, what are our options? Now, the South has alternatives. According to the April 2009 SAFE, Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, and World Resources Institute report titled Local Clean Energy, North Carolina can generate an additional 52,000 gigawatt hours of electricity from available renewable energy resources. This is about equal to 40% of current electricity sales. The graph there on the right is a graph taken from the report, and all these reports and fact sheets for all of our southern states can be found on our website as well as the WRI website. In that same report, data shows that Florida can generate an additional 40,000 gigawatt hours of electricity from alternatives, and this equates to about 20% of current electricity sales. Renewable and conventional power options are comparable in total costs for new generation, but renewables offer advantages in terms of water use, air quality, and climate impacts. So with all the renewable potential in the Southeast, why are we considering drilling away our coasts? I'm now going to turn it over to Susan, who will talk to us about what's going on in Tallahassee. Susan?
Hi. I'm being a little technically challenged. Somehow I couldn't get the webinar, but I have the slides in front of me. So, Tony, if you would go to my first cartoon. So for folks that don't know me on the phone, I've been that are on the phone that I haven't met yet, I have been doing public interest work for all my adult life, and I've worked, ironically, interestingly, for about 5 years fighting the tobacco industry, working on tobacco policy, and then moved into sort of the energy arena about 9 years ago, and came to be in the posture of fighting the utility companies as they were trying to build coal-fired power plants. And now, as if all that wasn't enough, I'm now getting to battle the oil industry, which is interesting. So our first slide is a great cartoon from Florida Today about big oil's offshore drilling PR blitz. And the bottom line here is it's really money at work. Last legislative session, which was toward the end of April in 2009, with 8 days left of the session, all of a sudden we were found out that the House was putting a substitute amendment for rather kind of innocuous memorial to Congress that dealt with drilling, but it wasn't a bill that was going to have the strength of changing any laws. And all of a sudden, they tried to put this drilling measure forward. And clearly, there's the oil industry has their eye on Florida's coast, and they're willing to put a lot of money up. They formed an LLC led by an attorney in Daytona called the Florida Energy Associates. His name is Doug Daniels, and they came in and hired a couple dozen top lobbyists in Tallahassee and a big PR firm, Ron Sachs PR firm, who traditionally came out of Democratic circles. He at one point had worked for Governor Lawton Childs and worked for the teachers, and anyway, a number of the environmental groups actually had him on contract working for them. So Ron Sachs firm, and then they turned around and hired an economist in Florida who's really an economist for hire named Hank Fishkind, and a lot of the folks in the tourism industry were particularly irked by him going to work for the drillers and cooking up all these very flawed numbers, which I'll get into in a minute about jobs and potential jobs and money. But he often had worked in the past for the tourism industry, and was just one of those people that if you were trying to get some numbers and you wanted certain kinds of numbers to come out, he was the guy that you called. And this is being led by a state representative named Dean Cannon, who is slated to be the next Speaker of the House, and he is from the Winter Park area. And what, you know, there's always in Tallahassee, there's the story that, you know, is sort of on the that people are talking about, and then there's the backstory, as is most many things in life. And the backstory for this thing has really been the money, you know, that they're coming in and promising large amounts of money to Representative Cannon for his effort to become Speaker. And when you're going to be the President of the Senate, the Speaker of the House, in the election cycle that precedes, you're taking that office, you want to make sure, quote, your people are going to get elected. So that would be money that would either go to the Republican Party. Now there's these campaign mechanisms called 527s, and they don't have to report in the same way that the parties report. And then, of course, you can also give a direct campaign contribution. One of the Gannett newspapers, so either through Florida Today or the Tallahassee Democrat or the Fort Myers News Press, there's a series that came out over the weekend, and they actually have a database on there if you want to sort of look up, you know, some of the money trail. So, but that's really what's driving this thing. So it's money. In Florida's nearshore waters, let me be clear about what we're talking about here. The effort at the state legislature is Florida's nearshore waters, which is 10.3 miles to the shore. There is a simultaneous debate going on at the federal level about drilling. Senator Brian Dorgan from North Dakota did pass an amendment on to the federal climate bill. The federal energy bill coming out of Jeff Bingaman's committee. That has not been merged with the climate bill yet, but it's in the mix to allow drilling 45 miles in the Outer Continental Shelf. So that's all over. But the state of Florida, the Florida legislature doesn't have any authority over federal waters. So this is just 10 miles to the shore. There's a lot of, Tony, if you would go to the next slide, there is a lot of opposition mounting to this, but it is important to have a context that because there's been a moratorium on drilling in Florida waters for more than 20 years, there really wasn't a active, you know, opposition on the drilling issue. Over the years, there have been a few things that have come up that we've battled up in the U.S. Congress, like in 2006 when Senators Nelson and Martinez did give up some of the area, and that's where the current moratorium was negotiated. There is a moratorium on drilling from 10 miles to 234 miles out from Tampa Bay, which is where I live, and then also about 100 miles from the military mission line up in the Panhandle. I'm going to speak to the military issue just a little bit later because that's a big, important piece. But up until this point, there hasn't been very much focus on the issue. So we are, one of the reasons that we're doing a webinar like this is to begin to educate more and more people so that we can help to ramp up the opposition. As I said, in some respects, we were caught flat-footed because it just hasn't been an issue that's been on the table. But meanwhile, lo and behold, that is what's happening. And as you can see, this long page of list of local governments already opposing drilling. One thing I wanted to do is as we go through this process, to have you all be thinking in the back of your mind about what something that you can do. Is there, you know, your local government or a local government nearby that's not on this list? Obviously, we have, sample resolutions from these other communities. So if you have any ideas. And Tony, the next slide, which are some of the coastal businesses, that's another area where people are waking up and realizing what's going on. And you can see a number of the Chamber of Commerce. A lot of this, a lot of the effort is been in the Gulf Coast. And there's sort of another thing I want to throw out to you all. A lot of people believe that there may be no oil or maybe a very limited amount of oil in this very narrow area, which is 10 miles to the shore. It's really, if you see any sort of coastal maps and about the drilling, you just realize that it's just this, you know, tiny area. So most people don't believe that there would be oil. And we've heard wild sort of promises from the drillers about how much oil there is so they can prove how much royalties they're going to get, which is what they're using to seduce legislators into passing this thing. So if because the state legislature doesn't have the ability to open up the federal waters because they don't control them, they've got to make this case that there's all this oil and there's all this royalty so that they can find support in the Florida legislature, right? If there's no money, you know, why would people risk the tourism industry and the jobs and our position with military training for that? So that's one of the reasons why the numbers are very important. To give you an idea about how off-base their claims are, and there's been big claims from $1.6 billion to, I've seen claims as high as $14 billion. And it's pretty extraordinary because even Texas and Alabama's gotten somewhere between 50 or 200 million, certainly nothing in the billions. And Texas, though, we're talking about state waters, is around $45 million. And that's, you know, but again, they're the part of the tactic and the dirty tricks and the money tricks is that they are making promises to all sorts of groups or constituencies. So they've made promises and offers to senior groups that this money would go to pay for senior programs, to clean up the Everglades, to go for, you know, they wanted to tie the money to Florida Forever, voluntary pre-K. And as some of you may even know, they managed to seduce the director and I guess some people in the board of the Florida Solar Energy and Energy Associates, the Florida Solar Energy Industry Association, into thinking that this money would be dedicated to solar rebates. So anyhow, coastal businesses are growing in opposition because they're beginning to understand what's going on here. Meanwhile, the drillers are making promises of money that many people don't even think exist. And, of course, it's easy to promise something that doesn't exist, that you're never really going to have to, a promise you're never really going to have to deliver on. So it's definitely politics at its finest, unfortunately. The next slide, I'm just to put up a quote from Colonel Arnie Bunch, who appeared on November 5th in Tallahassee, and they really made quite an impression. So you have these Air Force colonels and commanders up there, and they won't take the posture of telling people not to drill, because they don't take a position on that. But they basically, did say that if they were to open up this nearshore drilling, it would impact what they're doing. And the undercurrent of that was that they may just very well have to move. And for the Panhandle, tourism is big, but the military, the influence of the military community. So it is sort of interesting to have these interesting kind of bedfellows falling into line. So some people who normally wouldn't care about drilling at all and would be less concerned about tourism than you would hope for are pristine beaches. But when the military folks get up there, it's a pretty powerful statement. So I wanted you all to be aware of it. So let me tell you who's key, because I'm always about, we can talk about the problem all we want, but I'm very much into the, so what are we going to do about it? Senator Jeff Atwater, who is currently the president of the Florida Senate, is really a key player. And I just mentioned, you can see on the side, it happens that his great-grandfather was Napoleon Bonaparte Broward, who Broward County is named after. And interestingly enough, the history is worth looking at if you have some time on your computer. But he was most famous for wanting to drain the Everglades. So the first time that I ever met Senator Atwater, he sort of told that story and seemed to feel like he had a special obligation, I suppose, in part because of his family history and, protecting the environment. And we hope that that is the case and that he departs from his great-grandfather's terrible environmental legacy and instead really does to protect the environment. The interesting news, good news or bad news, but he is running for the Florida cabinet to be the chief financial officer. And remember that the proposal last year, and I assume the proposal this year will look something like it, is to open up, to require the cabinet to open up leases. So theoretically, he will be on the cabinet or could be on the cabinet. There, he actually doesn't have any Democratic opposition, which, usually it's not a good thing when no one's running against someone, because then they don't necessarily have to pay as much attention to your issues. But because he is running, he is paying attention to these issues, and he has a special reason to do so, in part because the cabinet would be the places where these leases would go. So he, unlike Representative Dean Cannon, the Speaker of the House, Larry Creedle, hasn't really weighed in a whole lot on drilling. I think, he's just sort of allowing Dean Cannon to do whatever it is he wants to do, and they're moving that along. So, Dean Cannon is really the player in the House, and Creedle is just sort of presiding and not, hasn't really seemed to weigh in much. But Atwater has announced that there's going to be a study, and I've actually been asked by the Century Commission to participate on the steering committee myself. There's going to be a dozen people. So the Century Commission, which is devoted to looking at the 25,000-foot view of Florida to look 25 or 50, 100 years down the road, they're going to help to coordinate a studying on drilling. And there's the Institute of Energy Systems Economics and Sustainability from FSU. That's a group that I'm not ready to vouch for their that they are unbiased in this. There have been some concerns brought up that they may have some sort of bias toward drilling, but anyway, we'll be keeping an eye on that, obviously. And then the Office of Economic and Demographic Research, you know, will be participating in that. One of the things I would just mention that I keep bringing up to people, and it's very much in tune with the focus of Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, looking for clean energy solutions, is that I don't think it's, if I was a policymaker, I don't think that it's enough to just simply look at, you know, whether drilling technology is safer or how much oil's out there or what royalty there might be or any of those things. I think obviously you have to look at those, get the facts on those issues. But what I would want to know as a policymaker is what is my alternative? And I think that that's sort of the challenge for all of us and groups like Southern Alliance for Clean Energy is to demonstrate that, you know, why would we want to drill when we have the alternatives? Drilling clearly is risky. Most likely any drilling that would happen wouldn't come on for 5 years or 7 years or whatever it takes to actually find it and bring the oil up. And of course, Tony's already did a tremendous job of going through all the problems with it, so I'm certainly not going to repeat that. But, you know, but as a policymaker, I would want to know that we have these alternatives. If getting a 10% rise in fuel efficiency and mileage efficiency, you know, and have 10% of Floridians achieving that would negate the need to drill the oil that's potentially economically recoverable, then why would you go in that direction when drilling has all kinds of other issues? And we talked about greenhouse gas emissions, but there's also just pollution, you know, air pollution that causes all kinds of problems, from asthma to respiratory problems to heart problems and so forth. So why would we, when drilling clearly has a risk, why would we risk the alternative? So that's something that I'm going to be bringing up. And if there's anybody on the phone that sort of has information or resource people, experts, academics at universities, you know, please bring them to our attention, because we want to bring that into the mix. I recently ran across a gentleman who was a retired Exxon executive in my community, because he wrote an incredible letter to the editor to the paper, and he did one of the best jobs of just encapsulating the false claims around the potential for oil that I'd seen, you know, because sometimes people can put things in real layman's terms. And he said that, you know, to achieve the 16 billion barrels that Hank Fishkind was claiming, you would have to find 32 of the biggest finds they have ever found in the entire Gulf of Mexico in its history, which is 500 million gallons or more. There's only ever been 2 found in the entire Gulf of Mexico ever, and in order to get to Fishkind's numbers, you would have to find 32 of them in 10 miles to the shore, which again is a very narrow strip of area. And I thought that was a great visual way to articulate it. So I myself, you know, will sometimes just through acquaintances or through reading something in the paper, will find people who have expertise. It's not easy to find people who have expertise in the oil industry, because most of the people who do are actually working for the oil industry. So it's not always the easiest thing to find. So you guys are a tremendous sort of network out there, and if you have ideas, please don't hesitate to get in touch with us. So I've mentioned Jeff Atwater. He needs to sort of hear from everyone. You know, again, it's a funny thing in politics. You sort of assume that people, you know, are making those phone calls in, but they may not be. And so if there's anyone on the phone today that is going to put a call into Jeff Atwater's office, Tony, let's put out in the next day as a follow-up to this sort of his contact information, so we can get everybody doing that. He was at an event last week in my home community, and I got lots of people out, and it turned into be a very event very, very much focused on drilling. And, you know, he sounded like someone that really wasn't anxious to drill. He didn't, announce particular opposition, but he talked about that there wasn't an amount of money that was worth risking our beaches, you know, if indeed there is a risk. And so he talked in such a way that really made one think that he was likely, you know, certainly wasn't rushing to want to drill. Also in the Senate, that's my next slide, Tony, swing votes in the Senate. And when we open up for questions in just a minute, if you have questions on folks. So we've done internally, there's a number of folks who lobby in Tallahassee or have been working on this issue. And so these names are a conglomeration of what a number of us have come up with. And they're people who, you know, either are sort of leaning against or leaning for or smack dab in the middle. So Tony Hill from Jacksonville, Chris Smith down in Fort Lauderdale, Don Gates is in the Panhandle. He's one that I know our folks up in the Panhandle are pushing very hard. And Evelyn Lynn from Daytona Beach, Garrett Richter, who's down in the Naples area, surprisingly enough, really, really needs to hear from people. And I'm convinced, and this is one thing, politics has changed a lot in the years I've been doing it, but one thing that hasn't, if they hear from a ton of people in their area, that's the strongest thing that we can do, more important even than all the drilling money, believe it or not. But we've got to, but we have to, are the ones that have to make that happen. So Gary Siplin is from Orlando. He chairs the Black Caucus. I was actually at the Black Caucus meeting, speaking on energy and drilling on Friday at one of their issues forums. And they, the cynical part about the Energy Associates just a couple months ago was an article that went around that they had hired three black lobbyists to work the black legislators. And so if anyone, you know, ever wants to get cynical about politics, they've hired a good gentleman named Bernie Friedman, I guess, to work the Jewish legislators in Broward County. And so anyway, there's always those personal politics that they employ, and since they seem to have all the money in the world. So we are a little bit concerned about some of those influences. Jeremy Ring is down in Broward County, another very progressive person. I remember last session talking to him myself, and he said that he wasn't so convinced it was dangerous. He was going to vote against it because of them bringing it up in the 11th hour last session, but we know we have to work on him. Joe Negron was just elected to the state senate, I should say reelected, because he'd been in the legislature previously. He has announced his opposition or concern, but I think he really needs to hear from people, but he's certainly swinging our way from what we can tell. Larsenia Bullard, who's down in South Florida, down in the Homestead area in the Keys, needs to hear from people. Senator Constantine, I think, leans against drilling. He is the chair of the Environmental Preservation Committee, and that is the committee that the bill is going to go to. So he's very important, and while I think that he leans against us, I mean, excuse me, against drilling, I know that, you know, again, he's probably not being super outspoken because the bill is going to come to this committee, and he wants to, you know, just give it a fair hearing, I suppose, but he could use to hear from people. And Senator Michael Bennett, who's down in Bradenton in Sarasota, is someone that very much needs to hear from people. He's always been a drilling opponent, but he seems to, not so much that he's weakening, but that's the end result, but he's been saying to a lot of people things like, oh, this is a done deal and it's going to happen and we just need to make it better. And that's the drillers for a while were doing a pretty good job at putting forward that myth of millions that this thing was just happening. Now, of course, with Atwater taking a stand, I think that's going to go away. But we've had a lot of momentum to overcome, and I would pat myself on the back and all of the people, Eric Draper from Audubon and Sierra Club and Wildlife Federation, and I'm missing lots of people, but there are a bunch of good folks working on this in a very under-resourced way, and we've collectively done a pretty darn good job of pushing the momentum back. Probably one of the most important people, too, is Nancy Dietert. She's another one of those examples. I mean, if we don't get Nancy Dietert and Mike Bennett, we're in big trouble. So Nancy Dietert is a kind of moderate Republican from Sarasota, Venice, sort of south area. She actually just filed the Renewable Portfolio Standard bill in the Senate. That's important because last year the bill, the Renewable Portfolio Standard, which is a target for renewable energy, and many of us have been working on that bill for years. It's a key policy for moving clean energy forward, but ironically that bill passed the Florida Senate and was met in the House with offshore drilling. The House never took up the RPS, so it's significant because it's all intertwined in the politics of this issue, is what's going to happen with the Renewable Portfolio Standard. And Senator Dieter took the bill from last year. Our bill sponsor last year, Jim King, a couple months ago passed away from pancreatic cancer, and so they're this is the kind of the Jim King energy bill. And I know that the House plans to move that bill out early in the session. The last two, Steve Ulrich is from a senator from Gainesville. he's asked some questions like, isn't it possible just to do natural gas drilling? And I know that he has very, very close friends who own vacation rentals where I live, and so a number of us are pushing through some of those personal relationships. I think he would be leaning for drilling, but if anyone's in that area. And then lastly is Thad Altman on the East Coast. Again, someone I would think would lean against drilling, but he really, if they don't hear from people in their district, it's so, so important, then it's easy for them to sort of get lulled into, you know, the leadership. I didn't mention the incoming president of the Senate as much, Mike Haradopoulos. So the incoming Speaker of the House, Cannon, is really pushing this, but Haradopoulos is committed to filing, you know, the bill in the Senate. So the worst of all possible things is to be working against a bill that's being sponsored by the incoming President of the Senate and the incoming Speaker of the House. So congratulations to all of us. We're working on one of the most difficult situations. So let me move away from the legislature, Tony, if you go to the next slide. It is very, very unusual that an issue of this magnitude, as important as it is to the state, and as much coverage as it's getting in the media, and as big as it all is, that it is being funded and pushed by people who will not identify themselves. It's pretty outrageous, frankly. The drillers say, as you can see one of the quotes, David Rancourt, he is the lead lobbyist for the Southern Strategies Group, and they're sort of heading up the lobbying effort. And, you know, every time he opens his mouth, he talks about how these are God-fearing, tax-paying citizens. They call them wildcatters. That's the word they used. I am 100% convinced that wildcatters is a word that they got a favorable response to in a focus group, because it's just one of those words like, how would you not like wildcatters, you know? They sound so like all-American, kind of John Wayne-esque. Anyway, I think that's just a made-up word, frankly. But that's just Susan Glidden's personal opinion. So that's one of the interesting things. You know, when this first started, I talked to some, you know, smart people who knew politics and the issues, who just were convinced that it's got to be the multinationals. It's got to be Exxon. It's got to be BP. It's got to be Chevron. You know, who knows? And then there something new sort of came onto the scene a couple of months ago. One of the things that some of the drilling proponents say is that there's drilling or going to be drilling in off of Cuba, and that China and Russia both could be drilling there, are drilling there. And so I started to get very interested in this issue of China because I thought, well, it is sort of odd that we don't know who these folks are that are pushing the drilling. And, you know, they seem to have pretty deep pockets. So especially in this economy, you know, there's only so many people, so many folks, so many institutions or countries that have that much money. And one of them is China. So when people start talking about China drilling off Cuba, I thought, well, why wouldn't China just want to come up the coast of Florida, if that was the case? So lo and behold, our rumors and thinking about China aside, in the beginning of the month, we saw some articles coming out of the New York Times and Dow Jones Newswire that Stato Hydril, which is a Norwegian company, was selling their oil interests and subsequently have sold oil interests in the Gulf of Mexico to the China National Offshore Oil Corporation. So China has actually bought leases in the Gulf of Mexico. So one thing that's interesting, and, you know, when you're working on these things as I am, you're always looking for what are the angles that are going to move people. And I have found, this is just informally in talking to people, the people who are supportive of drilling, when you mention the idea that it could very well be China. And, you know, we're not just doing something to throw something outrageous out there. I mean, that is a real possibility now, with what's going on, that, you know, even if some independent oil producer gets the lease initially, that they could transfer them to some American subsidiary that's controlled by the Chinese and so forth. Now, I personally don't subscribe to sort of the xenophobia, but there is a certain element of people who are very pro-drilling who would be very concerned about China drilling off our coast. The other thing is background I wanted to mention is that the drill, the rig that was on fire in the Timor Sea was built by a company called Sea Drill. And Seed Drill just signed a $630 million contract with Devon Energy. That's one of the biggest independent oil and gas producers, and they have a lot of leases in the Gulf of Mexico. So Devon Energy's just signed the $630 million contract with Seed Drill, and then has just announced in the last week that they are going to be selling their leases in the Gulf of Mexico, and of course that China is very interested. So there's a real interesting sort of web, and the fact of it, the matter is oil drilling is very much sort of a global industry, and it's one of the reasons why when they claim all these jobs, that's pretty unlikely that, you know, Floridians are going to get these oil jobs because they bring people in internationally. But so by its nature, it is very international, but it is a concern. So then lastly, I have another sort of fun cartoon for you guys to wrap up here. And this came out, there was a lot of rumors when there was going to be a special session on the Seminole Gaming Compact that I guess everyone's looking at the cartoon now, but you have a couple hookers under the light next to the legislator, and the guy in the limo says, "Hey, you in the gray suit, I hear there's a special session just ahead, feel like party." And that's kind of how it feels a little bit as someone who's been in Tallahassee during the legislature for 22 years now. I've never quite seen the town painted with money like it has been. So it's it really is part of the underpinning of what we're up against. But the issues are big, and I'm so happy that you all were able to all be on the phone just to learn a little bit more about what's going on. And hopefully the most important part is for you, your commitment to, you know, to take an action or two or get others involved in whatever way makes sense. So, Tony, let me turn it back over to you.
Thank you so much, Susan. I really appreciate the inside scoop, and I'm sure people on the phone do as well. The next slide you're looking at are things that you can do. Like Susan was mentioning earlier, first and foremost is to contact your elected officials and voice your concerns about offshore drilling. And SAFE has a toolkit on our website. There's the URL where it gives you a little, you know, ways to look up who your representative is if you don't know, as well as sort of, you know, just tools that you can use when communicating these sorts of issues. Also, on SAFE's website, by the end of the week, you will see a take action page directly related to offshore drilling, so please come back to our site and check that out. I also encourage you all to join either the Southeast Coastal Climate Network or the Florida Climate Alliance. These are two groups that SAFE manages, and many of you that are on this call are already a part of those groups. This is a great way to stay in tune with what's going on climate and energy issues in the Southeast, or if you live in Florida, specifically in Florida.